Well, good afternoon, everybody. It is Sunday, April 19th,
19th.
2026. This is one of the pre-convention events for the CCB convention program of the California Council of the Blind. I am Frank Welty, the chair of the CCB Housing Committee, and we're going to be having a housing rights or housing issues workshop tonight, where we're going to be informed with information that we can share with our community to help them when they have housing challenges, and that may include us as well, depending on the situation. So welcome aboard. We're going to be having a couple of very interesting presenters. First off, we're going to have Warren Cushman, who is a systems change coordinator for the Community Resources for Information Living in Berkeley. That's CRIL, they call it. That is one of the 27 or so independent living centers around California, and we're very proud of the work that Warren is doing in advocacy. And one of the areas of advocacy that Warren is responsible for in his work is housing. So he's going to have a lot to share with us about that. Also, we're going to get a personal perspective on housing rights from a person who has dealt with experiences as a tenant in a situation where she needed to exercise her rights, and that is Patricia Nash, who is currently president of the Bayview chapter and also president of California Diabetics in Action. So we have some great people here tonight. I will request that unless you're going to be asking a question, please do stay muted because we don't need the background noise. And it sounds like you're doing all a good job. So with that, we will begin. And Warren, thank you so much for being with us this evening and sharing your experience and expertise. And we are recording this so that we can save the information for others who will want to hear about this later. Welcome aboard, everybody, and we will begin. The
Hello,
floor is all
everybody.
yours,
This is
Warren.
Warren Cushman here. I am a systems change advocate at Community Resources for Independent Living in Hayward. For those who have been around a while, I've been a member of the CCB since 1991. I've been an advocate in a lot of issues and in a lot of ways for a long time. And in 2023, I was hired by CRIL to be the systems change community organizer at CRIL, and I love my job. I have learned so much in the last 3 years in so many different issue areas. Tonight I'm going to be talking, or this afternoon I'm going to be talking about housing. And I started my housing work as a unpaid advocate, oh, maybe 6 or 7 years ago with the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, which is a COG or a regional government in the Bay Area. Everybody has regional governments in the state of California. And depending on if you're in San Diego, you have SANDAG. If you're in Sacramento, you have SACOG. I'm not exactly sure what the LA one is, but somebody will shout it out. So there's plenty of COGs in your areas to connect with. And what those regional governments do is they are planning and policy and funding agencies that pass through funds from the state to cities and counties. So several years ago, I was involved with that group, and I started learning about housing work. And then about 5 years ago, before I was hired at CRIL, I started getting into the realm of tenant protections, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. So I'm going to be highlighting about four or five different kinds of tenant ordinances or ordinances that affect tenants. And I'll describe a little bit about what each one does. I am not an expert at this, but in other words, not a legal expert. But I certainly, as an advocate, have been in these fights for quite a while. So when about 4 or 5 years ago, the Alameda County Board of Supervisors brought a package of tenant protections to the community, and in that package was just cause, which is essentially a kind of ordinance that keeps tenants in their houses and protects tenants from being evicted. Now, each one of these ordinances is sort of tailored to the local community. So with just cause, for example, It's governed by a law, or yeah, it's a law, AB 1482. And what that does is it allows landlords certain, or gives landlords certain reasons why they can evict, and prohibits landlords from evicting for other reasons. And there are, I think, maybe about 21 reasons why landlords can evict, and then there's a whole bunch of reasons why landlords cannot evict tenants. And so what was happening was the Alameda County was taking some of those provisions and they were altering them. One of the biggest one had to do with prohibiting tenants from being evicted. And the large part of that space, the large part of that piece was there's a loophole in the statewide just cause ordinance that essentially it exempts all single family homes from being evicted. In other words, if you live in a single family home, you are allowed to evict your tenant without just cause. And the Alameda County supervisors are trying to change that loophole so the people who had single family homes would not be able to evict tenants. And that process was a very long drawn out process that took 5 years. And eventually what happened was there was a compromise. As many people know, in politics, we have compromises. And so a deal was struck between the tenant rights advocates and the landlord advocates, or the real estate industry, and some of the apartment owner associations. And that deal essentially ended up not favoring the tenants' rights advocates. It was a sad day for us advocates. We lost the ability to protect the tenants in that case. And it was a hard lesson for me because I put 5 years of energy into this fight, and only to find that the political reality was that the powerful industry groups were heard in a stronger way than the tenant advocate groups. So, that was a hard lesson for me. And before I go into the other parts of the ordinances, which I will go into, I want to stop because I can't hear the chat. I know there's chats and things going on, so I want to stop and see, folks, if you have questions or you want to make comments, just raise your hand or be called upon. I said, Andrea, are you going to be calling upon people?
Yes.
Okay, so just raise your hand and let people know because I cannot pause to hear the chat if you have any questions.
Good. Warren, can DJ ask a question?
Yeah, if you want to, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay, I do have a question. If I were, because I have my own house, if I were to rent to somebody, or no, have a friend, have somebody stay here for a period of time, is there a point where they then are considered a renter and have renter rights?
The
I mean,
answer
I'm
is
not.
yes.
Oh, okay. So if
Yes,
you.
the answer is yes. Even though, and this gets complicated because it kind of depends on if you have an in-law apartment or a what they call an accessory dwelling apartment, or if you have any way of differentiating between one place of living and another, then the tenant's rights get stronger for the tenant,
Oh, good. No,
which is
that's.
kind of. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. They call those laws for accessory dwelling units.
Got it. Yeah, well, there's
So,
getting to be more and more of those. So that's very good. Yeah. Well,
and so, but even in a case where you're just renting a room to someone and you're literally living in the same house, just using the same bathroom, there are some rights for the tenant, yes.
how about for family members?
Yeah, anybody who's renting, if you're actually renting, and there's separate bank accounts and separate, if you have one person who's, say, paying the mortgage, and then the other person might pay the person who is paying the mortgage, there are some rights at court with the
But
But
if
tech,
I
yeah.
let them, like my grandson, live with me for free, he's 18. So if I let him live here for free, does he end up with tenants' rights after a certain amount of time, or is
Well, it would
that?
depend on whether there was a lease and an agreement, a tenant agreement, or whether it was just kind of, sort of casual and there's no rent involved and you're just sort of, helping somebody out and there's nothing on paper.
Which is that's what it would be. So it would just stay that way.
Yeah.
Okay, that's just good to know. All right. There's good and
It's
bad on that, I guess.
well, right. And again, the laws are always changing because the legislature is always trying to move the targets. And
Yeah.
not only do you have the legislature move the targets, but every jurisdiction that you live in wants to do local stuff. So you're going to have local jurisdictions, each with their own little, vignettes of what the system's going to look like.
And so, am I correct? Ordinances are city determined,
Yes. Yes.
not
S
county?
both city and county.
Got it. Okay.
You could have a city ordinance, you could have a county ordinance. Anything beyond the counties, you're going to have laws from the state or even the federal.
Okay, thank you.
Warren, you've got another hand.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sheila, go ahead, dear.
I kind of know the answer to this already, but I know that others may have this question. If a renter has Section 8, or a housing choice voucher is the other name for it, whether it is one that can be moved from place to place, or whether they are, by reason of where they're staying, covered by the HUD, I'm trying to think, Housing, Urban and Development, at the national level, do they have more rights that help protect them better than these ones that are not quite what they need to be?
Well, that's a very good question because those are also changing at the federal level. The answer is we certainly hope that those rights continue. And they essentially have had in the past more federal protections under the Housing Choice Voucher Program and HUD. But like every other realm of government, those targets can move, so we just have to keep advocating. Any other questions?
You're clear right now.
Okay. All right. So now we'll move into a couple of other related ordinances that I also had some experience at working. They are the Rent Registry and the Rental Inspection Program. Now, the Rent Registry is pretty simple. It's the county or the city, the local government jurisdiction, finding a way to make a list, usually through their city or county tax collector or some form of real estate, sometimes the apartment owners can send the counties or cities their lists. It's not as accurate and effective as having like your tax collector or your city department keeping track of tenants. Those registries are very effective in sort of tracking the needs of tenants. There can be ways to check for habitability issues, like if you have rats in your house or if you have bed bugs in your house. Really serious stuff. I'm going to try. It's, so, you know, th there's here where I live, which is unincorporated Alameda County, we run into people, tenants who have terrible conditions, mold, and things terrible in their homes, in their apartments. And unless you have a way of tracking those things, you don't always know what's going on. So the county is still trying to solidify their list so they can track these tenants and see what the heck is going on with them. Once they have the list, then they can check on them. They can, generally the way that this county does it is they work with the apartment owners associations to check on the large ones first, because there's 150 apartments in an apartment complex. It's easier to grapple with that than to go two by twos. So that's the registry. The other one is the inspection piece, and that does go along with the registry in the sense that once you have the list, you can then inspect the units for all the things I talked about earlier. And we are trying to, in Alameda County, we're trying to strengthen both of those even now, both the registry and the rental inspection. And then finally, the last one is really interesting. Well, actually, I'm going to bring up one more after this. Fair chance. Now, what fair chance is really simply people who are formerly incarcerated and are looking for housing and have problems because of their previous journeys, are asking our county to loosen the laws so that they actually get a better chance at housing, because obviously they are being discriminated against by apartment owners and other folks when they try to rent. And so we're trying to discourage that discrimination in Alameda County, and pass a local ordinance that would make it clear that people who are formerly incarcerated and are looking for housing and pass background checks and, go through all of the same normal kinds of things, credit checks and background checks and all of that, that they don't just get tossed because they have criminal records. Now I'm going to again pause and see if anybody has any questions. Doesn't sound
Roger,
like
go
it.
ahead.
Go ahead, Roger.
Yeah, go ahead, Roger.
Hi, this is Roger Peterson. I think you remember me.
I do.
I wanted to ask you, I live in a condominium, and I just wondered if there's any, all this stuff you're talking about, is there any special note to be taken of condominiums?
The biggest is the condominium associations that most condos have. Generally, those condo associations have boards or some way of governing themselves, and they have their own rules. Each condo association has their own rules. Now, those rules can't be used to discriminate or throw people out or something like that, but they are things that tend to govern the condominiums. And usually, when someone moves into a condo, the condo folks usually give them the rules of the condominium. And of course, the question is whether or not they're accessible. We want to make sure that, the condo associations need to provide those rules in an accessible format. Whether they do it or not, I suppose, is another question. But they should. And Roger, the thing about the condo associations is they are registered with their particular cities and counties, so there is an interaction between the condo associations and the government agencies.
We just got our front door thing where you can, call somebody to let you in. They changed, and they changed it to a touch button thing, which is inaccessible.
Oh, I
I
was
love
afraid of that.
it. Thank you.
Well, you're down in Mountain View. Am I right about that, Roger? You're in Mountain View?
I'm sorry, what did you?
Are you in Mountain View?
Yes.
Okay. So the
Here,
best
it
advice
has
I
been
have,
over 40 years.
I am in Hayward. Mine is in Hayward. So my best advice, other than, of course, working through the housing committee, would be to contact the independent living center in your area and let them know about the discrimination. If someone
Well, I
faces
served
discrimination,
for
go
the
ahead.
for a while, so I can do that. Thank
Yeah,
you.
I'm
You
gonna
bet.
interrupt just for a second because we have two other hands raised.
Go ahead.
Okay, Josh, go ahead, please.
Okay, this is Joshua Saunders, and the reason I'm speaking up is I just got reminded from something from when I was in law school, like several years ago, and that is Every condo, as Warren said, they usually have agreements that you have to sign with the condo association. And if you get a condo, it's very good to sit down and read through everything and make sure that the accessibility stuff works and works with what you have. This is sort of for future reference, because almost every time that these condos associations are sued, they almost always win. So it's really important to make sure that whatever condo you're moving into for the future, read the agreement thoroughly and make sure that these are things you can live with. And it's as simple a thing as your doors have to be blue. It can be something as basic as that. So just make sure if anyone is moving into a condo in the future, sit down, read the agreement if you can. Make sure you get it in an accessible format that you can read it before you sign those papers and stuff. Okay.
Thank you, Josh. And I would
Okay.
also say if you are in a homeowners association, if you have a lease and you're renting an apartment and you have a rental agreement, same goes with what Josh just said. Go over those papers and make sure you're aware of what's in them because there can be surprises.
Okay, you currently have three hands. Do you want to take them
One.
now or do
Yeah,
you
I'll
want
take
to
them
wait?
all, one
All right.
in order.
Frank, go ahead.
Okay. Of course, there are a lot of people who buy condos not to live in, but to rent them out. So do the rental protections that apply to people who own apartment buildings or, say, individual apartments apply to people who own individual condos that they're renting out?
It depends on the size of the condo. If it's, say, like 15 condos or 20 condos or less, it's going to be different versus if you have where I used to live, where there was 100 and some odd condos in one area. So it just depends on how big they are. But I think Josh is right, Frank. Even in the case of, a huge condo complex, it really the condo association really guides the trajectory of that. And it's like Josh says, it's very rare to overturn the condo association.
Yeah, but I'm thinking in terms of I can understand that if you're renting from say like if you rent from somebody who owns a condo and you're staying in that condo as a renter, that you're subject to the rules of the condo association just as if you were a condo owner living there. But I'm saying that as a renter, do you have renter protections from the guy who owns the actual condo
Yes.
unit? Yeah, that's what I
Yes.
thought, but I just wanted to be
Yes.
clear about that.
Okay, next we have, excuse me. Okay, next we have Chris Gray. Chris, go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you. So, just a quick comment because this is a very thorny, tricky area in housing. I've lived in condos for much of my life, much of my adult life. My parents didn't own a condo, of course, but anyway, it's very upsetting to me the things I've seen, especially in my work with ACB, but with the state organizations, not CCB, thank God, but I have seen people have their guide dogs seized from their condos and impounded because the condo association felt things were happening inappropriately. Now, of course, there always could be a situation where that's true, but in all of these cases, we got the guide dogs back for the families, for the owners, and it's a very difficult situation.
Agreed. And I think that ultimately we're here to advocate. And if we run into a situation where a blind person has their guide dog taken away from them or, other kinds of situations, they, might have rats in their condo or something horrible like that, the housing committee and the resources at the independent living centers are need to step up and do the job.
So I think a good message for me to take away, don't forget your independent living centers because they can help you.
Yes, and we do actually in Hayward. So I have one other interesting thing that we're doing here in Alameda County right now, which is tied to the housing element. Now, for those of you who don't know what a housing element is, the state of California, through the Housing and Community Development, which is a statewide department, well, I don't want to say demands, but requires, which I guess is the same thing. The state of California through HCD requires every jurisdiction in the state, every city, every county, to develop and submit a housing element. And what that essentially is it has to do with affordable housing, and it is an area-wide plan that every city and county is required to submit to show that they're making progress in affordable housing. I'm not going to get all the technical details, but it's really about affordable housing and showing the state of California that each jurisdiction is making progress and is doing something about affordable housing. Now, the reason this is relevant is because part of the process of that is something called inclusionary zoning. And what that essentially is a plan by which the local jurisdiction looks at the percentages of affordable housing units in their jurisdiction and puts a number to them in terms of how many people are above the median income, how many people are below the median income, and how many people are very low and extremely low. And now there's even something called acutely low. So these are all federal numbers that each jurisdiction each jurisdiction goes by, and then you adjust it based on your local area. And don't ask me to rattle off the numbers in Alameda County because I don't know them all. But there's a median income, and then there's for affordable housing. If you go below that median income, there's three levels: there's very low income, low income, and extremely low income. And then there is a category called acutely low income, which is for people who basically get an SSI check or get in that has income that's from zero to about 15 or something like that, 1500 a month. Those are people who are just struggle. And so the reason I bring this up is because the most jurisdictions are looking into this inclusionary zoning ordinance that will reflect those numbers and hopefully get an affordable housing. It's something worth looking at. In fact, the whole space of housing elements they're very complicated, they're very data driven, and I still don't know everything about the inclusionary zoning and the housing element, but I learn every time I get a crack at it. So, but it is something to point out in your jurisdictions if you really want to get deep into the policy side of affordable housing. So before I turn it over to Patty, are there any final questions for me? Well, it doesn't look like it. So, Patty, the floor is yours.
I've been a tenant for 57 years, and the first apartment I rented was only $85 a month. Now, in California, the average monthly rental is $2,695, and it's less in certain other locations. Certain locations, it's $3,501. It depends on where you live. But anyway, over the years, I've had to learn about tenants' rights, and I've had to fight for some of mine. I was a Section 8 voucher holder and in a unit, and we got new owners, and my rent was really reasonable. And the new owner raised our rent by $450, and she only gave us 2 months to pay it to for the raise to go into effect. And because I was on housing, I had to pay 200 of that. And if you're on housing, you're low income. And they said, well, we haven't changed the fair market value, so in about 5 months, when the new year happens, then you'll be okay. So that was really good. But then she started charging us beyond what we paid for our utilities that were covered in the portion that they take out automatically. The housing takes an amount out that you pay. Then she was going to charge us anywhere from $50 to $56 a month, and it would change every month. And I said, you can't change our rental amount because it's standard. And she said, well, this is for water and sewage and garbage, and who's going to pay it if you don't? So then I heard there was this guy named Michael Finney on Channel 7 News, and he's a really neat guy. And he talked about rights of all kinds, what your rights are. And he said that if something isn't in your lease and you don't get a bill for it, you don't have to pay for it. So I went downtown, well, to Oakland, and there were some lawyers who worked for free for low-income tenants and other people who needed help. And so I talked with one of the people, and she was really kind, and she said that well, I didn't have my lease with me, and had asked my manager, the new landlady, for one. And she said, well, they didn't give us our paperwork, so we can't help you with that. And I was told that they're always supposed to be able to provide you with a lease if you don't have one. But my caution to everyone is to keep all of your paperwork. I'm sure most of you do, but keep all your paperwork, because you can really get into trouble if you don't. And in issues, especially where, let's say, now hopefully it won't happen to any of us, but if we had to be evicted, usually the tenants might win in cases, but the reason they don't is because they don't meet the deadline specified in the paperwork that they get. Anyway, so she said, Michael Finney said too that you didn't have to pay it. And so we had a tenant landlord person in housing, and they had been charging us this money for enough time that I got a check for $1,000 back, and she managed to get it back for all of the tenants, Section 8 tenants. But the manager that was in charge of the building, while the new landlord came in, she said that she wanted to get rid of all the Section 8 tenants. And she said, we're not going to ask you to leave, but we just don't want them here. And I was kind of appalled. And she said, so I'm interested in the rights that we have, and I'm going to tell you some of them. And if you, Warren, if you, I don't know how much time I have, so, but I'm glad I helped all the tenants that were Section 8 to get that help. And in landlord tenants' rights, there's a cap on annual rent increases. It's 5%, but it's kind of tricky because in certain jurisdictions it could go up to 10% given inflation. And I know why, that was why they got the big rent increase that they did in 2017 that I told you about. But now I'm going to tell you some other things that I know, because I've been reading about tenants' rights for a while. Your security deposit cannot be more than your rent, your monthly rent. And after 1 year, if they wanted to evict you, they'd have to have a reason, a legal reason for the eviction. And they can't charge increase your rent more than twice a year. And you can opt out of bundled services like internet. You in 2025, you now have to have a working refrigerator, a stove, and they have to have a flexibility in your security deposit. And if, let's say, there was a an evacuation, they would halt your rent. You wouldn't have to pay while you were out of your place. And there also has to be a disclosure when you rent a place of any fees. And there's got to be positive rent reporting for larger properties. And let's see, I'm just going to, there are places you can go on the internet to locate necessary forms that you need if you have to go to court. And let's see, there's a whole lot of other things. A tenant has the right to a habitable place. It has to be warm and clean and safe from hazardous materials like lead-based paint and mold and let's see, asbestos. And we had all of those in the building that I was in at the time that I told you about. And so they had to post signs so that we'd know it. I do want to say a few things, because we want, as Frank said, people to come to our committee and, you know, like each chapter have a liaison or to report to our committee if somebody has a problem that we could help with. I wanted to tell you too that the homeless population in our country and in California has increased 18% from 2023 to 24, and 2024 are the only figures I have, but there are now 187,084 homeless people, and that's 24% of the whole nation's population. And we feel that there are probably some blind or partially blind individuals in that category, and we would like to figure out ways to help them. Let's see. I'm not done yet. Oh dear. Oh, now I've got to get to my. Okay, here we go. In addition, in California, tenants have an additional protection from eviction if they've lived in a property for more than 13 years. And I didn't know that they didn't have to provide a refrigerator till 2025, since until 2025. The landlord must ensure that your structure's plumbing, heating, gas, and electrical systems are in good repair and functioning and properly. And they also, your responsibility is to, so that they don't get upset with you, is that you have to report any repairs that need to be made as soon as you know about them. And when you do make a deposit, when you rent a place, the landlord has to protect that deposit in a government-approved scheme and return it at the end of your tenancy, unless there are legitimate deductions for damage or unpaid rent. And they say there are damages that they had to repair that were made. They have to provide the receipts to show you that they really made them. Let's see. Okay, I have some more things I wanted to say. Oh, I already told about the eviction protection, huh? And if you are evicted, they have to provide valid reasons, of course. They can't just evict a tenant simply to raise rent or to find a new tenant. and extended notice periods to 60 days or 90 days are now required for certain types of evictions, giving tenants more time to find alternative housing. There was a time when I lived in a really wonderful home, and it was back in the 70s, and it was a two-bedroom place, and it had a few issues, like it had mold, but it had a real huge backyard, and my son was only three, and we had a slide, and we had swings, and I was growing tomatoes and real pretty flowers like sweet peas, and I was about ready to buy the place, and the cost of the what you've paid to buy mortgage was within the range that I could pay because I just started a new job, but the person that I was dealing with, the real estate agent, passed away. And the owner of the building was in his 90s, so he just decided to rent it to two brothers, and he only gave me 30 days to get another place. And I was working, and I found one, but it was only a one-bedroom, and it was on a really busy intersection, and there wasn't anywhere for my son to play or anything. And then the next place that I moved into, I had the son, and they were going to put new carpets in when I was getting ready to move in. And I was so worried that because he was a boy, I thought, well, I better pay for the carpet. So I said, well, I'll pay for it. So I did. It wasn't a lot of money. But then one day when I came from work, there was water coming down from the upstairs. It was a townhouse apartment. There was water coming down from the bathroom and into the kitchen. And it was because the toilet tank had cracked. Don't ask me why it happened when I wasn't working. There wasn't anybody in the apartment, but he charged me for it. And he said, I can't pay for all of your mistakes. But, you know, now I know that there's protection for us, that we can read the laws and know what they are, and I also belong to a group of disabled tenants, not a union, but a just where we talked about tenants' rights and just cause evictions and caps on rent increases. And I think that we were instrumental, all of us have been, if we speak out. And that's the most important thing that we really need to do, is to be sure that we have a voice. And I might have, does anybody have any questions or anything yet?
You've got a couple hands, and great job, Patty. Excellent.
Thank you. Thank
You've got
you.
Two participants. Hold okay. on. Warren, go ahead, please.
Warren,
if you got your...
There we go. Good clutter. Okay, so, Patty, first of all, I just want to ask you, would you say that in the last, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, have you noticed a significant change in attention by the legislature to propping up and supporting tenants' rights in the last couple of years?
That's a hard question. 'Cause in some ways they have. I mean,
I've noticed it, so I was just wondering.
We have caps on the amount they can increase the rent, and they have more rules about habitable housing, habitability of housing, Because oh, but we have responsibilities too, though. If you have pests in your unit, you're supposed to take care of them. There's a law that says you are. I'm trying to find some of the new laws that I have, but I noticed that since the AI happens when I'm reading, they have this line underneath everything that you're reading, so you have to read it slower, and then after you've read for a while, they kind of say, well, why are you here, or what do you need, and then we can track your location. So, but I'm just learning, and we, you know, I don't know.
Fine, Patty.
Thank you.
Patty, also, fine. do you think, well, let me just sort of ask you, do you think that people who are tenants and need affordable housing and tenants' rights and all of that, have you ever heard of someone going to a legal, or like Bay Area Legal Aid or any other legal organizations for support?
Well, I did.
Okay.
And it wasn't legal aid, though. It was a Native American center, but there were certain days when you could get some free advice. And oh, and she was very helpful because she got a copy of my lease, the attorney or legal person that helped me. And while I was showing her a paper that I'd gotten from the landlord, she saw another envelope and it was addressed to my son, and she said, you know, because you're on Section 8, you can't receive anybody's mail that isn't your own, because you could be evicted for that reason. They could say that he lives there, even if he doesn't. That's proof enough that they'd need that you. So I had to tell him, you can't have your mail sent here anymore. Let's see. Are there any other questions?
Yes. Sheila, go ahead, dear.
Thank you. I don't have a question. I have a comment. I want to remind people that there are tenants' unions. Oakland has one. Berkeley has one. So in your city or maybe your county, if it's kind of a small rural county, you might see if you have a tenants union. If you don't know how to find it, you can call 211. There are referral services that can tell you about lots of things in your county, but including that. But the other thing that I raised my hand for is I have Section 8 and I live in an apartment, and there was a big nasty thing that I had to deal with. In 2017, I finally figured out how to get this fixed. My landlord had two water heaters here in the property. It's a duplex, and each water heater was supposed to be for one of the two parts of the duplex. And instead, I was paying for the hot water for the upstairs unit. And I'd finally figured out how to get that proven and everything. But I had to fight for it a lot. And it happened such that I was... It took them almost 3 months to fix it, even once they were notified of it. And I learned from that, because they got to the point where they were about ready to start abating the rent, meaning that they would no longer pay the landlord, even though I was paying my part of the rent. And it was really stressful and really scary. And I pretty much was honest with the head of the Section 8. I said, I'm not going to tell you guys anything. I don't absolutely have to, because if I get threatened with you abating rent, I know that the landlord isn't supposed to kick me out, but you know damn well they will, because they want someone that will pay their rent and where they won't have this problem. So the way that we have to report things that are wrong, should not come back and bite us in the butt, but they do. It's scary. And I don't know if there's an answer for that. I mean, I did reach out to Just Cause. It's an organization here in Oakland, and my local ILC for some ideas and some, you know, what to do about this kind of thing. But it's pretty stressful. It's supposed to be for your benefit, but if it hurts you, it's not for your benefit anymore.
It really is intimidating when you know that your landlord really does have a measure of control. I mean, if they want to, they could try to evict you if they don't like what you're doing. They don't see that you belong to some sort of a union. And yet, in the material that I live in a HUD building, and it's a community-based project. And we have the right to meet even within our building and discuss tenant rights and tenants' responsibilities. And we have a place where we can discuss all aspects of our habitability. And they're town hall meetings. And sometimes I think it's a little bit too intrusive because, you know, they'll have to tell some people things. I feel like I'm back at school or something because I attended those two schools for the blind. And, but, you know, it's nice to know, like here, for instance, they do repairs within a day. If you tell them that, oh, let's see, what was it the other day? It was just this one cupboard door. It squeaked, and every time I'd be on the phone, somebody would say, "Oh, your cat's meowing," and it was the cupboard door. But he fixed it right away, and you know they keep it really clean here, but it does cost more to live in a HUD location than it does a Section 8 voucher rental. I mean,
it can, yeah. It depends on how it's set up.
Yeah. So
interesting, because I assumed HUD and Section 8 were the same. You know, people throw these terms around. This is Andrea, by the way, and you don't always know what it is that I've never lived in HUD. In fact, when back in the 80s, when I got my first apartment with a friend of mine who had a child, we were lucky we found a landlord who would rent a two-bedroom to us, because back then they could insist that you had to have an extra room for the child, and we could not afford a three-bedroom. There was no way. I was in school. She was working. She was getting welfare and trying to go to school too, and it was just, but we found a guy who would, and the master bedroom was huge, and he said, I can, but he said, because she was waiting to get on Section 8. She'd applied. He said, when you get on Section 8, you have to leave because I'm not going to rent. I will not take Section 8. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't know if they can even still do that. I assume they have a choice and they don't have to take it. But,
they do.
Yeah, but he had told us right up front. And she ended up living with me for about 10 months. But even finding a place that would rent to us with a child was really, just a difficult thing. And like I said, they throw these terms around, and unless you really know, it's confusing.
And I don't know if it's changed about renting to children, but it did used to be very difficult.
So what I want to say is, I don't know all of the different ifs, ands, and buts and wherefores, but when it comes to subsidizing housing, there are several different programs with several different criteria, and I don't know them off the top of my head anymore. I used to know them better when I was looking for housing for myself and others more often. But I know that some are more expensive and some are less, depending on how the rent structure is settled. And so you kind of have to sniff and you kind of have to fish and look for things that are like some amenities are part of the rent, and you can maybe find a place where you don't have to pay for that if you don't want it or something. Also, there are some subsidies that have to have a bracket. You cannot have an income lower than X or higher than X. And so that's, that can also be a factor of it. And I
just stop you, Sheila, for just a second. Yeah. It's almost 4 o'clock. Frank, I don't know how long we were going to go. And I don't know if Warren or Patty has more to add. We don't have any hands. Thank you, Sheila. We don't have any hands at the moment, but I just wanted to, you know, to confirm that.
I'm checking to see if I've missed anything, because I feel like I went through some of the rights really quickly, and I was afraid maybe I didn't make them clear enough. I don't know, but we have of course basic rights too, that we have protection against age and our sexual preferences and our ethnicity, and that's important to know, because I remember that one of my friends in the 70s was going to rent an apartment, and well, he wouldn't let her. He said she had to cut her hair because they had a swimming pool, and he didn't want to get hair in the drains. And which, you just can't let yourself be intimidated. And especially when you deal with government entities which have pages and pages and pages of forms that you have to fill out, like 25 maybe each year. And you get used to them, and they're for our protections and theirs. So it's really good. I know you're hungry, aren't you? Yes, you are. So I don't think I have anything else. But
great job, Patty.
Yes, I just want to break in and say that I want to thank both Warren and Patty for sharing just a lot of really great information this afternoon. And I want to thank everybody who came today. This program is being recorded, so when that is made available, we'll certainly let the word out so that people can go back and listen to it if they weren't able to attend, or if you want to hear it again. I want to make a point that, again, the CCB Housing Committee, our purpose is to help members of our community with the housing challenges that people can face, whether it's as renting or whatever. So you're welcome to reach out to the Housing Committee if you have questions. Keep in mind that some great resources that you have are, of course, you can start with calling 211 in your area to get information and referral, so that if you want to find out what housing resources there are in your area, you can start with that. Contact the nearest independent living center and talk to an advocate there. They'll have a lot of good information. I'm forgetting the exact website, but it's the state's Housing and Community Development website has a ton of information that you can explore there. And we will probably put articles in the Blind Californian in the future with more information. One thing that we want to do much that you can take back to your chapters is that if your members of the chapter want to be more active in terms of being in a position to help people in your local blind community who face housing issues, that we would encourage you to either organize a housing committee or appoint a housing coordinator, and to get that person to get in touch with the housing committee. By the way, we are still looking for more members, especially in areas that we're not yet representing. We have a lot of people in the Bay Area. We have people in several people in Southern California now, like L.A. and Orange County and I think and the San Bernardino County area. But we can use more folks around the state because this is a big state. So
And I live up in Eureka.
if this is something you have a passion about in your heart about being a resource for people to help them with their housing, then definitely reach out to us and join the committee. Thank you all for coming, and we hope
Frank,
that
we've
you.
got a
Thanks,
hand.
Frank. Oh, go.
Sheila.
Okay, Sheila. Yes.
Ahead, Sheila.
I'll be super quick. I just wanted to say that if someone doesn't know how to find their local independent living center, get ready. I'm going to give you a website.
Okay.
This is for the California Foundation of Independent Living Centers. So this is an organization of organizations. And the website is www.cf, as in Foxtrot, ILC.org.
Definitely.
California Foundation of Independent Living Centers. And if you put your address, if you put your zip code, there's an edit box there that you can put your zip code in, and it will show you the area, the independent living center that services your area. In some cases, more than one are listed because they're close enough together that it's hard to figure out whose is which, and you just kind of have to figure that out by, you can call one of them and they'll help you sorting it out. But yeah, that's all I
And we
have.
have, and we
Great,
thank you,
great
Sheila. We have
resource.
one more hand. Allie, go ahead, please.
Hi, this is Allie. I was wondering when your guys' committee meet up.
We normally meet on the second Tuesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. And yeah, if you're interested, get in touch with us. Again, this is Frank Welty. I'm the chair of the committee. If you look back through past issues of The Blind California, we've had some articles in there. So check those out. And yeah, love to have you on
Okay.
board. Or even if you
Cool.
just want to check, if you don't want to join the committee, but you just want to check in and ask a question or something, people are welcome to come in.
And you guys meet on Zoom as well?
Yes, we're on
Yes.
Zoom.
Yep.
Okay.
We're not, we don't bite hard, I
No,
promise.
we don't.
No,
We're folks, nice people.
it's fun. We get to share news, recent things we learned.